Thank you, Ed. All right, so thanks for hanging around here so long. We have the last session now, and before I start, I would like to say that it's really been a fun week, and actually the workshop program is also great, so I enjoy very much being here, and I thank everybody who made that possible. Now, it was also very nice of the organizers to give me complete freedom on what I want to talk. I mean, you're going to see whether you're going to be happy with my choice or not during the next half hour or so. But I really try to entertain you a little bit, and in doing that, I'll try to be very, very simple. If I'm not, please ask questions during my talk as well, because I hope you will be able to follow what I'm going to say very easily. So I converged on talking about the circumstellar medium of massive stars because I think it connects quite well with many, many topics which we have been discussing here during the conference. And so I want to start out with the problem of envelope inflation, which we have been discussing already during the workshop a bit, and it came up also in the early time during this conference, and it relates very much to the stellar Eddington limit. So the Eddington limit is something you all know and probably understand. It's a balance between acceleration through photon momentum. The photons want to leave the star, and it's balanced by the gravity. And so you can very simply derive the expression for the Eddington limit. And that's all the math really I do here. So I want to point out that there is just constants here, the mass and, well, the opacity. And so what impact does the Eddington limit have in stars? If stars exceed the Eddington limit, do we get a Big Bang? My first order answer to this question will be no. I'll try to convince you of that. So in order to see the physical effects of the Eddington limit in stellar structure, what we need to look at is opacity. Now, okay, opacity is terribly complicated. So I just want to give you a look here at these two plots, which show the opacity as function of temperature. Here for relatively low density, so this is a density parameter is defined as density to T6 to the third power. So we have lower density, higher density. And if we go even to higher density parameters, we are on this figure here. Now, these type of opacities hold for the envelopes of hot stars. And here we deal with envelopes of cool stars. And in case you can't read the numbers well, they are important here. So, oops. So we got a peak here at maybe 200,000 or 150,000 Kelvin. We have the electron scattering opacity floor here at roughly 0.4 square centimeter per gram. And if we deal with low density hot star atmospheres, well, the opacity can be increased due to bound free, and so on, opacities by a factor of 2 or 3. That's already a lot for massive stars, if the massive stars are close to the Eddington limit, obviously. If we deal with cool stars or denser atmospheres, it's a very different scale here. Now, I'm sure you can't read that. The temperature axis is almost the same, except it's inverted. So we have low temperatures here, high temperatures here. And the scale goes up here to 10 to the 5. So the opacity in cool stars can be very high. For example, in the Sun, we have opacities which are of the order of 10 to the 5 square centimeter per gram. So I'll work with numbers of 2 and 1,000 for just illustration purpose in the next diagram. The other thing which you can see here from this plot is that the opacity increases with density. That's not surprising, it's two particle processes. So in other words, if a star manages to decrease the density in its envelope, the opacity would go down. All right, so then let's look at the Eddington limit. So we can plot stellar mass, stellar luminosity. Just from the equation of the Eddington luminosity, we get a line here with slope one, so to speak, linear relation with mass. You also know the mass luminosity relation of stars. I think we had a similar diagram in Stan's talk. You see that even to the highest masses, these lines don't really match up. Yeah, so this is based on real stellar models. There's a paper in the literature by Kato from the 70s, which shows that you need to go to 10 to the 5 solar masses until these lines really meet. Now this is just considering the electron scattering opacity, and the question is what happens if you fold in the real opacity. So let's do this factor of 2 for the iron opacity in hot stars. And you see these two lines now do cross roughly at 100 solar masses. Well, who cares about stars above 100 solar masses? So that's a zero H main sequence. If we look at, again, stellar models for evolved stages during core hydrogen burning, we get higher luminosities towards the end of the main sequence phase, and so we get these lines then to cross roughly at 30 solar masses. Now that's already a little bit more scary. It would imply that a massive star of 30 solar masses or higher would see the Eddington limit during the hydrogen burning phase of evolution. If we look to the cooler stars, of course, this goes further down. This is a factor of 1,000 in opacity. Now these lines meet somewhere at 7 solar masses or so. If I would put the 10 to the 5 square centimeter per gram opacity of the sun, then this would meet at 1 solar mass. And indeed, in this considerations, the sun is indeed very close to its Eddington limit. And I think all the pulsations we see in the sun actually have to do with exactly that fact. I concentrate on massive stars, so I don't discuss this anymore during this talk. So let's consider what happens with the massive stars. Now, how does the structure of a star react on seeing the Eddington limit? You see that here in this plot. What is plotted here is the density distribution as a function of radius in a star of this mass, probably was born with 100 solar masses or something, just as an illustration. And what you see is that we have a relatively ordinary stellar structure up to 30 solar radii or so. And then the star has what we call an inflated envelope, more or less constant density, which extends to 150 solar radii. So it's an ordinary star inside a very, very fluffy extended envelope. How did this structure come about? Well, so as I showed you, the stars of the upper main sequence do see the Eddington limit, and then they evolve with time and increase the luminosity somewhat, not very much, but enough to have a big effect. And so what the envelope of the star will do is it will always expand as much as to not overcome the Eddington limit in the end. So the reason that the stars have this possibility is the density dependence of the opacity. The fact that the stars expand the envelope brings the opacity down, and in that way they just do not exceed the Eddington limit. So when this star becomes even more luminous, then what will happen is that it will simply inflate its envelope even further. That brings the opacity down a little bit, and the Eddington factor will remain the same, namely very close to one. That's the stars. That's how the stars adjust to seeing the Eddington limit. Now, We have done this with stars up to 500 solar masses. None of the stars really has a real problem with the hydrostatic equilibrium ever. All the stars do, they build up these envelopes and inflate. And of course, at the outermost layers, the density is even smallest. And so none of these stars ever reaches the Eddington limit really at the surface. Yeah, so the highest Eddington factor we would find here in these layers, where the inflation starts. And all this envelope is very close to the Eddington limit, but at the surface, the Eddington factor is never exceeded. So no Big Bang, just a hydrostatic inflation on a nuclear timescale, something very, very slow. So we've explored how this works in the upper Hertzsprung-Russell diagram. So what you see is luminosity, effective temperature, and we've sampled it with our stellar model. So each dot is one stellar model coming out of evolutionary calculations. And what you see color-coded is the amount of inflation which the stars show. So green is, or if we between green and blue, then the radius of the star has doubled. If we're yellow, the radius of the star is multiplied by a factor of 5. We stop the scale here, but the most inflated model do inflate by factors of 10 or 20. And so what you see is that essentially above a luminosity of 5.4 in log, all the stars do show inflation. And so this raises immediate questions. One is that all theoretical nonsense? Should we believe any of this? I think that the stars do have to deal with the Eddington limit is clear. What we can see in this diagram is a line which separates where the inflation is below a factor of 2 and above a factor of 2. And this line is roughly coincident with what we know as the Astorados instability strip. So we see the luminous blue variable on the right side of this line. And so the idea might be that indeed if the inflation is very strong, maybe we get unstable envelopes, envelope instabilities to the extent that the stars are not ordinary anymore. I want to point out the envelope masses. So the amount of mass in the fluffy bit is a strong function of the effective temperature. So for the hot stars, there's tiny amounts, 10 to the minus 3, 10 to the minus 4, 10 to the minus 5 solar masses. However, I want to point out that if we go to cool stars, we get really a lot of mass in these envelopes. So the upper scale here is 10 solar masses. Our coolest models have of the order of 5 solar masses in these inflated envelopes. So this is all core hydrogen burning stars. And I find it interesting from the point of view that it's the first time I see how in a stellar atmosphere an amount of several solar masses is sort of isolated from the star, put at large radius at almost zero binding energy, and is ready for more. Yeah. You will understand what I mean with that in a minute. So what I've shown you is that if we have if massive stars hit the Eddington limit, at least in our models, there is no Big Bang. On the other hand, we see the LBVs. So perhaps what we need is some fast evolution of the star such that the envelope can't react, such that the envelope gets destabilized. And so what I've plotted here is as function of the zero H main sequence stars, an evolution through hydrogen and helium burning in terms of observable stellar type. So how this works is you just put a star here, 20 solar masses initially, and then it moves vertically up and you see through which phases it might evolve. Now this is schematic, but so we have of course all kinds of supergiants here, maybe W and L stars for the highest mass already on the main sequence, and then you get the Wolf-Rayet stars up here for the higher masses. And what I think is conceivable is that we get an LBV stage between hydrogen and helium burning, because that's where the stars really are moving very fast, and maybe the envelopes can cope at that stage. And if this would be so, then we could expect a similar thing for those stars which do remain hydrogen rich up to the end of their lives, also after core helium burning, that means essentially shortly before the supernova explodes. And I believe we have plenty of evidence for both these situations. And so if I summarize what I've said, I want to extrapolate on what that might mean for LBV eruptions. Well, LBV eruptions would not happen for all stars that see the Eddington limit. Most of them would just become a little fluffy. So it might happen when the star which is at the Eddington limit is driven out of thermal equilibrium or has to readjust on a rapid time scale. And so I think we have evidence that that may happen after core hydrogen exhaustion, because we see one or two dozen of LBVs in the local group. And we know that those exist as LBVs partly for more than 10 to 4 years or so. So those are not pre-supernova stars. That means we have LBVs which don't explode tomorrow. On the other hand, we have also plenty of evidence that there are LBV eruptions happening, or LBV type eruptions happening in stars just before they explode. So I think we have both stages. We require LBV phenomena in both stages. And there's observational evidence for that. There's much to say about binarity. I think I ran out of time to do that in depth. Also, what is completely missing in this consideration is the role of rotation. Rotation would add another force in the envelope, the centrifugal force, however latitudinally dependent. And so we can speculate whether we get some really funny effects for stars which are partly inflated in the equator but not in the poles. There's also an investigation which was just published on the metallicity dependence. We have been discussing earlier during the conference whether LBVs, for example, or common envelope evolution would have a dependence on metallicity. If it relates to the Eddington limit, the answer is clearly yes. You can just look at the dashed lines here, which give you the limit above which the stars are at the Eddington limit for the corresponding metallicities in the colors here. And I would like to point out that even at zero metallicity, this phenomenon does not go away, because even hydrogen and helium have opacities which are non-zero, at opacities which are non-zero. So you would also have that at zero metallicity, even though at very high mass. Now this was all main sequence stars I was talking about. Of course, we want to discuss also the later evolutionary stages. So what we have found a few years ago is that red supergiants, when they move up the Hayashi line towards the end of their evolution, they increase very much the L over M ratio. And so they also see the Eddington limit. And what happens then is that they start pulsating. So what you see here is an evolutionary track in the Hertzsprung-Russell diagram of one of our red supergiant models. It's actually the model encircled over there. It's from a 15 solar mass star, just at the end of its evolution. And so what you see is essentially a pulsation with increasing amplitude. And what I would like to point out is that the amplitude gets very large. And at this moment in time, our code stops working. But I don't think the pulsation would necessarily stop at this stage. And so we do see that Again, I think essentially because the stars see the Eddington limit, that pulsations can start and bring the pulsation amplitude very high. And so we did that in 1997. I want to point out that the periods and growth rates we got with our stellar evolution code were consistent with linear periods and growth rates from linear theory, which Isabel Barraff actually, who is part of this, worked out with a linear scheme. And the implication then was that there may be extreme mass loss from such situations, just in the very late stages of evolution. Yun and Cantiello a few years ago did a similar study and found essentially similar things as well. They found that, well, if the star loses the mass too early, then this may actually also stop again because the envelope gets lost. So we may just have a shell formation. And then 2 years back, with Takashi Moriya, we did a study on population 3 red supergiants where this was also recovered. And this is the only study, I think, which really included the damping of the mass loss on the pulsations non-linearly in the calculations. But the mass loss enhancement was still very large from the pulsations. So my last slide on the inflation issue. Also in the Wolf-Rayet stars, we can find inflation. And that can be relevant for supernovae as well. So what you see here is, again, density structures of Wolf-Rayet stars. Just look at the full drawn line here, full drawn lines. Again, you see these fluffy envelopes hanging out there. It's the same situation as in the main sequence stars. And so this may be quite relevant for the shock breakout phase because we see here a star of 2.5 solar radii, the Wolf-Rayet star of 2.5 solar radii, had it a normal atmosphere, this is just a polytropic model, then it's the shock breakout time from such a model would just be the light travel time across the stellar disk, essentially. The reason is that the envelope gets optically thick very quickly. If one has an inflated envelope, so in this situation, we found that the shock breakout timescale can be enhanced by a factor of 100 because actually the shock is already seen essentially when the shock wave arrives down here, the photons diffuse already out. And in this supernova, it was one of the only cases, I think, where in X-rays the shock breakout has been observed and it had a very long shock breakout of 100 seconds or so. Okay, I want to switch gears and briefly talk about other mechanisms to influence the circumstellar medium of stars before they die. And one is the ionization confined shells. What the heck is that? So let's look at Betelgeuse. Betelgeuse is a red supergiant, which is the closest one which we have. It has a very peculiar circumstellar environment. It has a bar, which I don't want to mention anymore. It has a bow shock, so it's a runaway star. And the bow shock shields, of course, the inner parts, the part inside from the hydrodynamic flow of the circumstellar medium, of the interstellar medium, sorry. However, it also has an inner shell here, which you can see in this image, really. What you see here is just the blurry star. But in radio observations, it has been observed that there is another shell, a detached shell around Betelgeuse at a smaller radius. Now, we came up with a model to explain that, which works as follows. So, we have Betelgeuse here. It is a red supergiant which has a wind. The wind is shielded by this bow shock. The bow shock is otherwise, however, not important. Now, what happens if this red supergiant wind is exposed to an external radiation field, ionizing radiation field, is that in the wind, an ionization front is developing, and that ionization front leads to a shock here at this situation. And what this shock does is it confines the inner wind through its pressure, and with time, a shell is built up here, which collects roughly half of all the mass which goes off the red supergiant. So the shell, which was discovered by Lebetre in 2012, has a mass of the order of a tenth of a solar mass. It has this radius, and it's stationary. It doesn't move. It has zero velocity. So it just sits there forever, until the star dies, presumably. When we apply our photoionized shell model, what we need is an ionizing flux of this order, which could well correspond to the diffuse ionization field in the interstellar medium. And we infer that the stationary shell mass for this case would be one solar mass. That means that our prediction is that when Betelgeuse will die, it will be surrounded by a shell of one solar mass of material. So it's mostly Jonathan Mackey who developed an analytic theory for this, and we get some scaling, of the radius and mass of these shells, which with mass loss rate and ionizing flux. And what we find is that supergiant shells can have radii in this range and masses in the range you see here. We know that many red supergiants will be exposed to much, much higher ionizing fluxes than Betelgeuse, because Betelgeuse is isolated. But if you put a red supergiant in a star cluster with hot massive stars, the flux can easily go to 10 to the 13 photons per square centimeter in second. And so we think that this model can be applicable to type 2 N supernovae and also to superluminous supernovae. With 10 solar masses, you can get an interaction luminosity which corresponds to superluminous supernovae. Finally, I have a last piece of theory which may relate to rapidly spinning Wolf-Rayet stars. Now, rapidly spinning Wolf-Rayet stars, I'll learn it eventually. we probably deal with in GRB supernovae and in type 1 superluminous supernovae. And so what we have been looking at is at the radius evolution of such model stars. And what you see here is not mass loss rate. Sorry, that is a mistake. This is radius in solar radii. So here is one solar radius. And you see it as function of the central temperature for Wolf-Rayet star masses of this order here. So this is the late evolution past cohelium exhaustion. And what you see is that at least the massive models, what they do is the radius goes straight down. And so we looked into this a little bit more because, we wanted to understand why, because if it happens, it would have significant consequences. And so this is the plot which makes us understand why we see this. So what you see here is time scale. So this is time scale in years, 10 years, 1,000 years, and so on. And this is evolutionary time up to the core collapse. And so you have hydrogen helium burning here and then the late stages. So what we see here is the dynamical time scale of the star of the order of days or hours. And this is the Kelvin-Helmholtz time scale, 10 to the 4 years. Now the full drawn line is the true contraction time or radius change time scale of our stellar models. And you see they follow very well the Kelvin-Helmholtz time scale after cohelium exhaustion is what you expect. But then they go down very much. And the curve which they follow is the Kelvin-Helmholtz time scale, which is mediated by the neutrino luminosity. So the neutrino luminosity goes up very much during the late stages of evolution. And correspondingly, the contraction of the core is accelerated. And not only the core in these cases, in this case which is shown here, this is accelerated even up to the surface. So the surface shrinks down. The stars end up to become very hot at the surface in the end, easily 200 or 300,000 Kelvin. Now, if we have very rapidly rotating star, what will happen if there is such a strong contraction? Very, very simply, the star will hit critical rotation at the surface and has to fling off mass in order to remain hydrostatic. And so we calculated what mass loss rates we obtain in order to keep our stars hydrostatic. And so what you see is that, again, it's a function of central temperature here, the mass loss rates do go up to, well, maybe I don't learn it to the end, sorry, do go up to values of the order of 10 to minus 2, even 10 to minus 1 solar masses per year. So I don't know whether anybody really, any observation really calls for having very dense circumstellar medium around superluminous type 1 supernovae or GRB supernovae. But in a sense, we think it is unavoidable to get that because we have observationally the situation that we see type 1c supernovae. So that means there is no helium shell which could expand and mediate this effect. So the mirror effect in stellar evolution is not there. And we need very rapid rotation in these guys to obtain our magnetar or collapsar. And so it's actually unavoidable, I think, that these stars do spin up to rates which lead to very strong mass loss in the end. And so that's exactly what the models which we produced show. Now, we used chemically homogeneous models, but I would like to point out that the result itself is actually independent of how you get to the situation. Whenever you have a Wolf-Rayet star which has no helium and spinning very, very fast, it must fling off matter in the end. Okay, there's more things I didn't have time to talk about. I just want to mention them very briefly on this plot, which can affect the circumstellar matter, wind bubbles. So if you have fast wind following a slow wind, you sweep up a shell. So it happens late, you have it there. Bow shocks, again, give you stationary circumstellar medium structures. You know 10% of all stars are runaway stars. Binary mass transfer, if we have the mirror effect leading to late expansion, then we get perhaps another mass transfer phase. And mass transfer is non-conservative, so you spill matter around. And again, you pollute your immediate circumstellar medium with a lot of material. So how does this look then at core collapse? Well, we can have stationary dense circumstellar medium due to various processes here. We can just have that our stellar progenitor is at the Eddington limit and therefore inflated. So it may have a fluffy low density envelope, which you shouldn't confuse with a stellar wind because it would just be sitting there hydrostatically. It could have a wind on top of that, but it needs not have that. We can have ionization confined shells and red supergiants. We can have bow shocks from runaway stars. All this gives stationary extended dense structures around the star. Or we can have expanding media which have high density from, for example, the pulsating red supergiants, spinning Wolf-Rayet stars, or binary mass transfer. Now, I did not get back to the things which have already been talked about in this respect in this conference, but I think many of these things combine quite well. Pulsational pair instabilities, Dan Woosley talked about that, wave-driven mass loss, super Eddington winds. So just one example, if we have a star at the Eddington limit having maybe a solar mass fluffy envelope around it, if then Elliot and Jim's waves come and deposit energy at the base of this, it will be much easier to get this stuff off the star than if that envelope would not be inflated. All right, I want to stop here. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much.
Jörg?
The rapidly rotating Wolf-Rayet stars, the very compact ones, you say they go up to critical, and then you have a very high mass loss rate. What drives your mass loss there?
So it's a general feature of stars that when they contract, they get closer to critical rotation and they conserve angular momentum. So that's exactly what's happening here. Angular momentum transport has no time to do anything at this stage because it's past core helium exhaustion. They are already close to critical rotation, and then when they contract, they spin up even more.
And I'm not asking about the spin, I'm asking about the mass loss rate.
It's just the mechanical effect. So what we do is that we need to take off mass of the star to get the remaining object in hydrostatic equilibrium. So it's a purely mechanical effect.
He asked, what's the force driving it to infinity?
Centrifugal. It wouldn't go to infinity.
That's right, it would just differ.
Yeah, it wouldn't go to infinity.
Yeah, so a few years ago, I guess the Geneva group had a similar idea about centrifugally driven mass loss. And one of the points is that it's not being driven as a wind, it's being put into a disk. And the disk is still dynamically coupled. And so the angular momentum that's being transported outward is being transported outward through the disk, the viscous forces. And the total amount of angular momentum you need to lose in order to keep below critical rotation depends on how far out the disk you go. Because in a Keplerian disk, the specific angular momentum increases as the square root of the radius. So it's really crucial. And so in other words, how much mass you have to lose really depends on the properties of the disk.
I think the situation we have here is very different. Just look at the time scales here. So this is 1 year. So we have of the order of 10 years or 100 years time. So there is no time to you know get to equilibrium. I don't think we have Keplerian disks at all. We have just no possibility to keep the star to keep the matter bound at the star. You know that's describing the situation. So we don't have. Years. And this is years as well.
Neutrino accelerated contraction is quite neat. So this only happens if you've lost all of the helium, is that right? I just want to understand when, kind of the regimes in which this occurs.
It's not all of the helium. So this is homogeneously evolving models. And so what you see if we look at different masses, it tends to happen at the highest masses because there we lose more of the helium than in the lower mass cases. And so in the lower mass cases, you see partly the opposite effect. We get expansion because there is a helium shell coming out. But I'm not that much believing in homogeneous evolution that I would say that's the truth. What we see is if we take the helium away, then this happens. And what the observations tell us is that certain supernovae seem to have no helium, so it might apply to these cases.
Yes?
So I'm trying to piece together these two plots. In this scenario, what's the total amount of mass lost that you've calculated, and how long before the supernova does that occur?
So the amount of mass lost is highest in the highest mass model. So it's a few solar masses of material. It can be up to 10% of the mass of the star. And so the mass loss rate increases towards the end. And that's reflected then in the density distribution, I guess, which you find.
But is it mostly lost a few months before a collapse, or a few years, or a few decades? And I'm just curious sort of the rough when most of it comes off.
I could just not work with this guy.
I have to combine the two plots. It's hard to tell because this isn't mass loss rate.
So core helium exhaustion is roughly 1,000 years before the star dies.
Yeah.
And that's when these two curves here separate out. And then this looks linear here, but we have a logarithmic time scale here. So it's, I guess, an exponential increase in the mass loss rate.
They're both logs at the power law, right? So most of the mass loss,
late.
Most of the actual mass loss is right at
very
the end.
Late. Yeah.
Any further questions? I had a question myself. You had this enormously inflated atmospheres in the beginning of your talk. And Now, if you put one of these stars in an X-ray binary, you don't even need a wind to get the accretion onto the compact object, because I suppose that the compact object is already moving in this extended atmosphere.
So we actually have a project going on supergiant X-ray binaries. The puzzle which we're trying to solve is that why we see so many in the galaxy, while as soon as they get Droschlaub filling, they should actually merge. And these fluffy envelopes indeed help to extend the lifetime of them, because it limits the mass transfer rate or the mass loss rate from the star. Because once the envelope is sucked away, it has to regrow again to allow further mass transfer. And so this has a strong stabilizing effect in this phase.
And it's only a very small mass which is in this fluffy envelope.
Yes.
So it would not even block the X-rays, I suppose. They would still come out, I suppose.
They would still come out, yeah.
When the compact star moves through the...
That's right.
It's very interesting.
I have a question about the chemical compositions of these mass that have been lost due in this scenario of neutrino accelerated contraction. So are they hydrogen rich or helium, or what would be the...
So the models we use come out of homogeneous evolution, so they have no hydrogen at all.
Right.
And so part of the helium has also been lost in a wind during cohelium burning. So it's there's still some helium there, but mostly it's carbon and oxygen what's going off. Okay, so in the lower mass models, this mechanism doesn't really work well, so that's the ones where we don't get rid of the helium. And the more massive ones, they are massive enough such that they can blow off the helium in the Wolf-Rayet-type wind during cohelium burning.
And that is just what you need to get this broad line supernovae, I suppose, which have no helium at all?
That might fit, but these models are not tailored to that stage. I don't know whether they're in the right mass range or not. These are toy models just made for the point of understanding the spin up and neutrino accelerated contraction and mass loss.
Yes, once more.
So actually, I want to ask a question about the sun, which you said is really close to the Eddington limit. Where in mass or in depth below the surface is it closest to the Eddington limit? Is it the hydrogen recombination or?
Yes, it's not a hydrogen recombination.
So it's very close to the surface.
It's very close to the surface, but not at the surface. Indeed.
Okay, but if I go to a slightly more massive star that is, 8,000 degrees at the surface and isn't cool enough to avoid this recombination zone. Aren't those stars above the Eddington limit? We see them all the time. How do they exist?
I didn't have time to go into that. So if you go to a star which has on the main zero H main sequence 10,000 Kelvin, then the high opacity layers are so deep that you may get a convection zone, but convection can be efficient, and that's the point I skipped here. We need to have the high opacity zone in a region so close to the surface that the density is low enough that convection cannot just take over and carry the energy.
But at that temperature, don't they have that really high opacity near the surface if your temperature is near 10,000 degrees?
In 10,000?
Yeah, near. Yeah, so it's hot enough that its hydrogen is partially ionized.
Well, hydrogen is already completely ionized at that stage, so you need to be cooler to get the hydrogen recombination zone into the star. And iron is so deep.
Right. I'm not worried about iron.
Okay.
Okay.
If you solve mean free path equals scale height, given a fixed as a function of effective temperature with real opacities, I think you're fine with those.
I think. Oh, one last question.
Huh? My question is the.
Please wait for the microphone.
So So what kind of velocity that you would expect from these, you know, your neutrino accelerated contraction?
I was afraid somebody would ask that. We have no clear idea because radiation driven winds can't do the can't accelerate the material. Yeah, so it may not go very far in the end, but it develops, of course. When the mass loss rates are still moderate, then we may expect this has a velocity of the order of the escape speed of the star. But I think in the end, this velocity must come down because the mass load is too heavy.
Would it come back? I mean,
it may fall back partly, but there's not much time anymore. The star will explode.
Well,
I think that because of time, we have to close the discussion. Let's thank Norbert again.